Marital life changes dramatically when one follows these laws.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org. ELMAD.pardes.org.
Good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are listening from. This is Alex Israel from Pardes, and I am in conversation today with Rick Goldberg from Austin, Texas, and he is the editor and author of a volume called Judaism in Biological Perspective, Biblical Law and Judaic Practices. And we're going to talk a little bit today about explaining Judaism from a biological perspective. So, first of all, Rick, good morning.
Good morning.
Maybe we could start off by explaining to me, what does it mean to explain Judaism from a biological perspective? How is that a unique take on Judaism? What does it mean?
Well, the first thing you have to avoid is to trick out one in terms of the other. When you do that, Judaism is not a science, and the science is not a religion either. So what you try to do is to look for consilience. You try to look for things that are compatible with one another. The comparison that I make is very simple, and that is Judaism is a religion that is given by God to real human beings, to organic creatures called human beings. Nothing more is expected of Jews in terms of following the path, the halakha, that human beings can't do. So human nature being something that exists is very important in halakha. You can't overstep the bounds of that. On the other hand, when you're dealing with the science, with biology, and especially evolutionary biology, what is it about? It's about primarily finding the structure of human nature. So it only works within human nature, too, with human beings. It only works with respect to the evolved nature of human beings. So between those two things, there's a lot more consilience than you might imagine.
Well, I'm going to push you a little bit on this, because a lot of people think that if you're a sort of observant Jew, you don't believe in evolution. And that evolution and traditional religions don't go together. You know, you have all these creationists and, you know. So what do you think about that? Judaism and evolution, do they go together?
Well, I think beliefs are overrated. And what happens is, I'm not going to tell anybody what they should think or what they shouldn't think, but there is consilience there that I think is very interesting and very important. You know, Chazal tells us that we learn things from people not only who are scientists, but people who aren't even Jewish, about the halakha, not just in general, what we would call today secular studies, but we gain benefit from those aspects of, let's call it, science. That's sort of the path that I follow also in what I try to do.
Okay, so you're saying the two work hand in hand?
They can work hand in hand if you have the mind to do so. If you want to be somebody who wants to resist everything and say no to everything and say this exists, this is valid, but the other part isn't, then you can do so. But if you want to look at the reality of what can be, then you're fair to each side and you're interested in both sides and you see that they really don't conflict much at all.
Okay, that's fascinating. I read through several chapters of your book, and I have to say that they are incredibly scholarly. They reflect a host of Talmudic, Midrashic, medieval, modern sources. And so I was really curious before meeting you if you could just tell me a little bit about your Jewish story. How did you encounter Jewish learning? And how did you reach this point where you wanted to write about your Judaism from a biological perspective, but from such a scholarly vantage point?
Well, everybody has a long life path, especially if you're as old as I am. So to start the path early, I was in a family of committed Jews, my parents and grandparents, but they were for the most part secular. But my father was very active Jewishly, especially as a Zionist. So I got that part of it from them. I didn't get the Judaic part from them. But as I grew older, I found the value in it, especially in a particular professor by the name of Lyle Stedman, who I learned the importance of traditionalism when one talks about religion. And it's a long story that I've that I won't tell. The only thing I could say is that it struck me and it really swept me away so that I started to understand when people looked at religion, especially evolutionists, they tended to look for things that were modernisms and project that modernism backwards into human history. And so they've done what I consider to be an inappropriate model. So they get religion wrong when they explain it most of the time, the Dennetts and the Dawkins and these people. At about the same time I was in graduate school, there was a required course in sociological theory. And I took it from a professor who was an evolutionist. And his idea was that natural science and social science should both have hard data behind it. Social science should not be manufactured in that way that separates it from natural science, which he would say was biology. So I took to that also. And an evolutionary approach to religion began to grow in me. And then, you know, a Jew can read a few books and talk to a few people. The rest is history. It's been a lot of fun. I've been able to retire about 9 years ago and begin this, the actual scholarly work and the writing, and at the time that I've been retired. And it's been wonderful.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to relate to a couple of the chapters in your book because they really are fascinating. Judaism has this concept of the Yetzer Hara, or maybe I should say two Yetzerim, the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara, the good inclination and the evil inclination. Some people even imagine, you know, there are sort of two little people inside them, you know, one little devil and one little angel. But this really goes down to the question about whether human beings are, you know, naturally good or naturally selfish or self-interested, or even beings who are controlled by some sort of drives and more sordid drives. And you've done a lot of research into this. So how do you, from a biological perspective, view this dichotomy between within the human being? And what is the Yetzer? Is there really a Yetzer Hara, an evil inclination inside us?
Well, the Yetzer, remember in the Bible, in Tanakh, there is no good and bad Yetzer. There's only one Yetzer. And it's not a positive one in most aspects, although rabbinically it's interpreted as being both good and bad. So in the beginning, it is instilled in human beings right at the dawn of creation of human beings. It is installed by God in human beings as a natural, not a belief, but a something that influences strongly our behavior. It is as the
disposition.
A disposition evil from its youth. So that says about the Yetzer something that the God implants, and that it's something that we live with in a very significant way. Rabbinically, you get to the Yetzer, and it's bifurcated. There's a evil Yetzer and a good Yetzer. And there's lots of discussion amongst Chazal, amongst the rabbis, about exactly when you get this and how this works and how that works. And there are lots of discussions about it. But some conclusions can be drawn. First, that the Yetzer is not only implanted by God, but it's necessary for us in the context of our biological nature. That's how you can make the jump from one to the other. It's part of our biological nature.
Can I just stop you for a minute and ask, when you're referring to the Yetzer Hara, you said that the Torah tells us just before the flood, Yetzer Lev HaAdam Ra Min Urav, Yetzer of man is evil from the beginning, but you said it's useful. Are you referring to the propensity for sexuality? Are you referring to human beings, I don't know, greed for possessions? What do we mean by the Yetzer Hara? What are you referring to?
All of the above. All of the things that you do that you can call it selfishness, although that's a pejorative term, which is not the whole complete story of what the Yetzer Hara is. It means looking out for oneself as opposed to others. And this seems biologically to be and can be very easily described as a part of human nature, the nature of human beings. You would say if you're an evolutionist, you say the evolved nature of human beings. But it's recognized as there. And then rabbinically, the Yetzer Hara turns into something which is absolutely necessary, which is to say, without this bad Yetzer, we don't get married, we don't build a business, we don't do anything that doesn't inure to our benefit. So we're not angels flying around who are altruists. We're people who take after ourselves. On the other hand, Torah is the study of Torah is an antidote to using the Yetzer Hara in a way which is out of proportion to what you should be. In other words, which is damaging. So it's that balance that is created by the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov and the concept of Yetzer itself that enables us to be moral or immoral, depending on how you would define the term in the context of any particular person. But it's a balance that one tries to achieve over a period of time.
Wow. You quoted that a lovely statement where in the Talmud where it says, Barati Yetzer Hara, I've created the evil inclination, or Barati Torah Tavlin, and the Torah is like a...
Spice.
Spice.
Yeah.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Well, it's a wonderful analog, and what's interesting about it is a tavlin, which in this case is yeast that makes a dough rise and it makes bread more palatable, is a biological organism, right? Yeast is a biological organism. So when the yeast is a certain amount is put in, the proper amount is put in, it benefits because people prefer bread with yeast in it, with bread that is risen. On the other hand, if you overdo it and you put too much in, then the bread is not palatable. So it's a nice analog that the rabbis make in expressing one in terms of the other.
Okay. Another topic that you've taken your work to is the marital separation between man and wife, the laws of Nida and the whole marital cycle, the monthly cycle. And you talk about how even up to 40% of the month, an observant couple will not be intimate with one another. And some people might explain this as some element of holiness, of kiddushin and kiddusha, but you've actually explained it, and you've even done some empirical research about how it strengthens marriage and how it has a biological basis. So can you tell us a little bit about your research and your journey into this topic?
Well, I wanted to figure out a way to construct, to do an empirical study of a religious behavior. It is about a religious behavior being hilchot nidah, the way in which husbands are not available to their wives for approximately 40% of their cycle, and how these laws make sense biologically. And we did an empirical study, and we had hypotheses that were proven, which is to say, an hypothesis that men in marital relationships who follow hilchot nidah end up having a fluctuation in their testosterone, which is smaller and greater depending upon the cycle period that they're in.
That their wife is in.
Yes, that their wife is in, such that they end up being manipulated in a positive sense by their wife. Their testosterone is either raised or it's lowered depending on her cycle.
So, for example, when she gets her period and when they are not allowed to be together, the testosterone is higher or lower?
It's lower. It
it's
lowers.
Lower.
Sure.
And as they reach the point where she's going to go to the mikveh, what happens then?
What happens to the mikveh? If you look at the results, the data.
By the way, how many people were involved in the study?
There ended up being 19. We started out with 25.
Okay.
It was in Beit Shemesh. This is the religious study. We also did a control group in Austin, and the control group did about what we thought was going to happen, which is that nothing special was going to happen because obviously they weren't doing this. But in a biological type of empirical study, you have to do a test of quote-unquote regular normal people and whether or not there are cues being passed that would increase or decrease hormones, testosterone, even though they were not participating in any religious activity in Judaism.
Right.
But among Jews who were observant, it absolutely happened. And what happened is after mikveh, at that time, testosterone spikes straight up.
So what do you want to explain from a biological perspective?
Well, you can insinuate their fertility, but I wouldn't do that because you don't do that in an empirical study. The only thing you want to do if you're trying to reach a conclusion about what's wonderful and what's not so wonderful, I'm not your guy. But the empirical study definitely shows that marital life changes dramatically when one follows these laws. And it puts, not only is the wife during the period, Eidechad, the only witness as far as controlling what goes on. She's in charge of everything, not the husband. And in other ways, hormonally, she's also in charge of everything.
Wow. So
she manipulates.
Saying, according to Jewish law, the woman's the major controller.
I don't think there's any question about that. And Rabbi Lamb and others have come out and said that. Without having the data from the study, obviously,
But you also make a statement in your article about how this strengthens marriage and sort of limits the tendency, maybe the evolutionary tendency of men to want to have affairs or to want to go further afield.
Look, we're all regulated by hormones. We admit it, we don't admit it, we know it. It doesn't matter whether you admit it, you are. You're regulated by hormones. And sexual stimulation, like other kinds of hormonal activities, are regulated by hormones, testosterone being the main androgen that's involved in that suppression or that stimulation. So this is a way to regulate these. Now, I didn't say that that God hands these down as halachot for biological reasons. Again, one is not the other. But there is consilience between the two, and it does make a difference in marriage. Husbands are prone, for example, to do mate guarding when the wife is pregnant. That when the wife is available to the husband or to a man, the husband has a desire not to have their wife do extra pair, what are called extra pair copulations, extra pair mating, because they want the children to be their children. And there's a whole series of things we can say about that. But suffice it to say that the mate guarding is minimalized here. There's less jealousy as a result of that, because Jews, observant Jews, are usually living in small communities where people are watching each other. And there's no real question about what you can call mommy's babies, daddy's maybes. Paternity certainty is pretty well known there. So as a result, one can say that it benefits Jewish families substantially, hormonally, in a way that's tested. I'm not speculating.
Right. I'm going to try and squeeze in a third topic to this interview and this meeting. You spend about two or even three chapters discussing a sort of theory called costly signaling. You apply it to the question of sacrifices. You even apply this to the length of synagogue services, saying some people think that they'd like to spend less time in the synagogue, and you want to make a case that synagogue services are long for a specific reason. And this whole theory of costly signaling. So I find this a lovely phrase, and I'd love to hear more about it.
Well, costly signaling is a basic theory of biological communications, not just between human beings, but others. It was developed by Amos and Avishag Zahavi here in Israel, dealing with a bunch of social species of Arabian warbler. That's what they do. From that, you extrapolate into something much larger, which is to say, organisms, if they have a need to communicate with each other, there's certain rules to it. If they don't have a need to communicate with each other, if you're walking along a sidewalk and there's an ant somewhere or walking on the side, who cares? They don't care about you because you have no interaction, which is necessary. However, when organisms do have a necessity to communicate to each other, whether it's predator and prey or any other, whether it's mating, whether it's whatever it might be, a reason you have to communicate with another organism, if you want to send reliable signals that are believable, in other words, you want to use that word, peacocks are the main thing used. I'm not sure what peacocks believe and don't believe. But if they're to be believed by the recipient of the signal, whether it's females or whether it's males, they have to be reliable. How are they reliable? They're reliable only if they're costly to produce. In other words, if you can afford to do that.
In the case of peacock, it's that huge tail that they'll, you know, have to develop and have to pull around.
And the ones with the best tails, as recognized by the females, since they do the choosing, and this is true also with human beings, the females do the choosing. So in order to be able to impress females, you have to have whatever it takes to be attractive, whatever that's called. You have to be good at it. You can't fake it, because if you fake it, you look like a fool. If you can't get away, you can't fool anybody, because they're waiting for a reliable signal. If you give them a signal that's obviously phony, then not only don't you rise in terms of attractiveness or whatever, you go the other way.
So how do you apply this theory of costly signaling to Jewish applications?
Well, there are all kinds of applications with human beings. I mean, altruism itself is a question of that. Why would people give resources to other people who are not their kin, mm-hmm. not their kinfolk? Why would they do that? You're taking your resources away. This is the classic question for evolutionists, looking at human behavior. Why would you give away resources? And one of the explanations, and there are lots and lots of examples of this everywhere, as a matter of fact, is that you do that because you increase the value, your own value as a person, in giving it away, whether it's in a situation that we would understand very well, a charitable situation or whatever, to the extent that other people know about it, you become a more important person. And your value, you are seen as being more of a valuable person as a result of you, because you're sending a signal with what you do in a reliable way that impresses other people.
So when people would go to the temple to bring a sacrifice, it would be also a sort of a sign to other people in the community.
Exactly. And if you look at all of the halachot that are involved in korbanot, in sacrificing at the temple, it's very interesting. If you bring a cow, if you bring a par, that's an expensive sacrifice.
Right.
Who's getting sacrificed? That's the question you ask. So what happens? The owner of that cow, maybe he's got 25 cows total. He brings one cow up for an olah, for a sacrifice. And that's a big deal. That's 1/25 of what he's got. So what does he do? He's required to take the animal and lead that animal up to the place where he's the most visible. And everybody looks, and he puts his hands on the animal's head, and he does smicha. So everybody knows that's his animal, and he's the one making the sacrifice. That's the point that I would make. He's making a signal which is costly. This animal is valuable to him, but he's sacrificing this animal for everyone to see, and he becomes elevated as a result of doing that.
Okay, so this is a fascinating theory, but I'm really curious, what has this got to do with the synagogue services, the length of a synagogue service? Why am I sitting in shul for 2.5 hours on Shabbat morning?
Because you're sending a signal to others that you are behaving traditionally. Now, why couldn't synagogue services be 15 minutes? Why not? People complain. I'm a president of an Orthodox shul, and people say, oh, this, we could leave this out. We won't have to do that. It's a little bit too long. We're waiting for the kiddush, and it's taking a long time to happen. But synagogue services, why not? Why does it have to be 2-3 hours? Why can't it be 30 minutes? It's a good question. I think the answer is, if you understand costly signaling theory, it wouldn't be much of a sacrifice. It wouldn't be. You go there, and there are certain religions where people go to a, let's say, a church, and they sing a few hymns, and they have a sermon, and they're finished. Judaism requires more sacrificing than that. Usually traditional religions, traditional-based religions, have much more sacrificing in terms of the kinds of things we're talking about than religions that are not as traditional or non-traditional.
Okay. So what you're saying is, in a certain sense, some of these things like sacrifice and even like the synagogue service, their effect is also what it costs us and the effect that they have on our social environment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If people see you doing something, whether it's pledging to a charity, whether it's sitting in shul and coming to shul regularly, whether it's walking to shul on Shabbat when it's raining and pouring outside, whatever it is, you send a signal to other people that you are inconveniencing yourself. You're surrendering resources. Your time is a resource, of course. You're sending resource. You're behaving sacrificially in order to comply with halakhic obligations. Obviously, that's on one side of things. On the biological side of things, you are impressing other people that you're observant.
Wow, so that's actually interesting. In the sacrifice, in some way, is self-serving.
It is self-serving. And the sacrifice, I would argue, is the thing itself. Sacrificing is everywhere in human history, whether it's trinkets, whether it's animals or others, even human beings, for sacrificing, for actual killing or maiming or whatever. That which is sacrificed, the owner is the one giving it up. So why would he do something like that? The answer is there are traditions that require that they do that, and it's a way for people to become honorable, or more honorable than they would otherwise be.
Well, I've got to say, this has really been fascinating, Rick. I really want to thank you for coming into Pardes. I know that you've spent time learning in our Bet Midrash, and you're a supporter of Pardes, so it's really wonderful to have you here. And I just want to, if you've enjoyed hearing Rick, and you've enjoyed listening to his ideas, you can read much more with real wealth of sources in the volume Judaism in Biological Perspective, Biblical Law and Judaic Practices, and it's available on Amazon, so you can pick it up very easily. And I just want to thank you, Rick, for your time, very important time, and for sharing your interesting perspectives with us here at Pardes. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org. ELMAD.pardes.org.